Food & Wine magazine called Michter's the best American whiskey. And Michter's is the first American whiskey to be selected as Whiskey of the Year by Whiskey Exchange. Michter's, it's all about the whiskey. You're listening to In the Drink with me, Joe Campanelli. When I'm not hosting In the Drink, you can find me at Fausto or our new wine bar, Lalu. On today's episode, we had my friend Alice Firing. Alice has been an early and vocal advocate for natural wines. She's written several books on the subject. She is a prolific journalist, and she runs a great newsletter called The Firing Line that I highly recommend you sign up for. We had a great conversation about her new book called Natural Wine for the People. It's a book that I really enjoyed reading, and it's a great beginner's guide for the natural wine world. But I think if you're a little bit more advanced, you'll also find some really good information. Alice and I chatted about her new book, the process, the natural wine world, and some of our favorite natural wines. Welcome back on In the Drink, Alice.
Well, thanks. So nice to see you again.
It's nice to have you back on the show. We're not going to get into your whole history. You've been on the show before, spoken at length about it. So I want to talk to you about your new book, Natural Wine for the People. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Can you tell me about how this book came to be, why you thought it was the right time to write it?
Well, the actual truth is that a friend of mine said, you need to write this book because I was making noises about not doing another wine book. And she said, no, you've got to do this book. And so I realized that she was right. I thought that Naked Wine, my second book, was going to be this book. But it was narrative and it really told the story of natural wine and how it came to be and its background. I wanted people to have a context for it. So when this moment came down the road where it is the next big thing, people would actually know where it came from. So they would respect it. And as I saw what was happening over the past couple of years with natural wine being reduced to a style as if it was Napa Cabernet, that it was a cloudy thing, it was a funky thing, as if that's what made a wine natural, I realized that we needed to do a little guidebook so people had an accessible reference book to what natural wine was. So it was kind of needed to address some of the issues that I saw.
What was your resistance to writing another book?
I felt like I had said everything I had to say. I guess there's always more to say, but my goal was never to be a wine writer. It's something that, because I had something to say about it, that I did one book, another book, another book, another book. Writing about wine is not exactly the way to a retirement fund. And I just felt it was time to stop doing charity work because I was a charity case and I didn't want to continue to do charity work. So that was basically why my resistance to it. Also, The Dirty Guide to Wine, which is my last book, was a guidebook. And I really think of myself more of a narrative writer than a guidebook writer. So that was it. But I got over myself when I realized I wanted to do something fun that was visually appealing, that had great illustrations. And so I was tickled pink to actually write the book.
The book is fantastic. I would call it more of a guidebook.
It is a guidebook. Yeah, that was my resistance to writing another guidebook. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So you're thinking about how you can make a guidebook actually be fun.
Yeah, but my resistance is that because I consider myself a narrative writer, writing about wine has, I think, been bad for my actual writing style, and I wanted to go back to writing. So this was a little detour, and it is fun, and I'm proud of it.
It's certainly fun to read. And I love this idea that you felt that it was necessary and you had to put it out into the world because people were sort of pigeonholing natural wine.
Yeah.
It's something that I find as a challenge with selling natural wine. And I love how you spent some time talking about how natural wine can exist in many styles. Why did you think, where did you see that happening? Why do you think that it was so important to make that point?
Well, there was a story in The New Yorker that was set in Copenhagen. It was just a little talk of the town piece with my friend Sune Rossforth, who was giving Action Bronson a Georgian wine. And I think it may have been Yagos. So it was no sulfur completely zero sulfur. And it was like, said, no, man, this is too oaky for me. And it was like, it was raisin quivery, you know, only clay. And wood had nothing to do with it. And Action, because of his fame, has become a spokesperson for natural wine. And it was like, no, man, this is not the case. So there's so much misinformation for people who have way more fame than I do. And these people need to be set right. I'd really get extremely annoyed by the spread of irresponsible misinformation, which is all over Instagram right now and social media and people who use their fame for this. Yes.
Yeah.
So it needed.
I can think of a well-respected London restaurateur who was calling, is like, this is the best natural wine of Italy. And the winemaker themselves would not say it was
a
natural wine at all. And in fact, would say, you know, using organic viticulture is irresponsible.
Well,
which I think is interesting.
That is super interesting. And I've seen it in natural wine stories and they recommend, and I'm like, what is natural about that wine? There were people rejecting wines that were too clear as not natural when they're perfectly natural. And so I want people to understand that there's nothing the matter with decanting the wine. In fact, which just means that it's not just that you decant like a bottle, but it just stands upright for the solids to settle to the bottom like a quivery does. And if you take the wine from the top of the quivery, it's perfectly clear. And as you get down to the bottom, it gets cloudy. So it doesn't mean that the wine on the bottom is any less cloudy than the wine at the top. So when you start reducing wine to a style, like I see a lot of things on the market that are billed as pet nat and they're not pet nat, or a cloudy wine, then you let the floodgates open for people to mimic the style through technology, which is what we're starting to see. And it's hard to prove, but you know it when you taste it.
And if natural wine isn't a style, and I'm sorry if this is a boring question for you, one you've gotten a million times, but if it's not a style, what is natural wine? How do you define natural wine?
Natural wine, it goes back to, I think now, my famous quote of nothing taken away, nothing added. I just inverse the usual way that I say it, except maybe with some added sulfite in a minimal amount. And it's no heavy-duty machinery that will adjust the texture and the taste and the flavor of the wine by heavy machinery, those reverse osmosis, centrifuge, micro-ox, you know, all those kind of things. So it seems perfectly obvious what it is. And within that category, there's so many different ways of interpreting a grape. So to say that a natural wine is cloudy, like, no, it can be. Natural wine tastes like beer and cider. Well, no, but it can. Yet there's such reduction in thinking these days, that people want to lock up any category in a small definable box. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm perfectly happy with things that have a loose definition.
It seems like some people might be surprised that you can make an industrial wine that is cloudy and weird, mm-hmm. and a natural wine that is really clean and precise and might drink like a very classic Chablis, but
absolutely,
it's a totally natural wine.
Absolutely. And when it comes down to it, wine is, and even natural wine, is something that is worthy of study and worthy of, you know, like really doing your, if you love it, really learn about it. And it's just not something to knock back at 3 o'clock in the morning. Only something to knock back at at 3 o'clock in the morning. Yeah. You can do that too.
You can do that too.
And it has been done many times.
And now, I know you cover this in the book, but I think this is useful. Like, how does one go about ensuring that they're drinking wine that's actually natural wine? There's no third party. It's, you know, something could be certified organic or not.
Right.
Certified biodynamic or not. And certainly just because it's certified organic, you discuss it as well. Like, you could have like Horizon organic milk.
Right. Well,
that
would
doesn't
be
mean it's, you know, it's industrially.
Industrial organic. And there's going to be a lot of that around. It's going to be a lot more confusing. There is really no guarantee, because even if you go to your favorite natural wine bar, your favorite natural wine store, because there are these things these days, there might be some interlopers that get in just because the people who's selling the wine may be delivering a bill of goods and they may not even know. So the best thing to do is the back the label trick, which is certainly it's been going on for a long time, is know your importer. And there's a whole list of them in the book. That is probably the best thing to do. And, you know, like, for example, you're not going to find anything industrial in Jenny and Francois' book. You're not going to find anything industrial in Scuola Divino or Louis Dresner, et cetera, et cetera. The worst is that maybe your sulfur level will be a little bit higher, but there's not going to be any industrial technique. And then the other thing you do is, like any other person who wants to learn about wine, you drink and you drink and you taste and you taste and you taste. And then you go to classes and you begin to realize it's very easy to be able to recognize when a wine has been yeasted or when it has been scrubbed. You get that sort of inner sense go off, like, oh, there's something wrong here. Then you go and you do your research and work backwards. So learn. It's a fun thing to do.
Yeah, it's fun when certain things sort of fall into place after you taste a lot of wine. Like, oh, I tasted in the wine. I get it.
Exactly. And when, you know, for years, people would say Chablis is smoky. And really what they were getting the smoky from was that Chablis was incredibly highly sulfided. And so they're really getting more of a sulfur residue than they are reduction. And you begin to go, oh, I'm feeling excess sulfur here in my mouth. Or I do a series of dead or alive tastings. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's kind of a funny thing to do, and where I'm trying to show people what a yeasted wine, and I usually get a crappy Sauvignon Blanc from New Zealand, and I put it next to a zero sulfite Sauvignon Blanc, which is always fun because people think, oh yeah, you can always tell what a Sauvignon Blanc smells like and tastes like. Well, no, you can't. You have to look beyond the aromas and down to the flavors.
I love this idea of dead or alive. It's something that Jasko Grovner talks about a mm-hmm. lot, with the difference between the wines that he likes, at least. Mm-hmm. And he defines them as wines that are made with spontaneous fermentation and are unfiltered as well.
Right.
And that, I mean, those seem like two very important things to really capture the soul of the wine.
Yeah, it's really easy to figure out what a dead wine is like. For example, I was sent this orange wine, built as an orange natural wine that was made for Aldi supermarket in the UK. And I think this sells for £8. And it's built organic, natural, orange wine, £8, great price. I get it. I'm looking at this bottle. Now, it's not just not cloudy. It is squeaky, squeaky, squeaky clean. And that is when you don't just look for clouds. You can have a clear wine. But when you see that super, super, super hyper polished, you know that something is going on. So the first tip off, smell it. It's not yeasted. I'm relieved. It's actually a native yeasted wine. It's innocuous. It's completely inert. The wine doesn't go anywhere. I mean, could I drink it? Yeah, I could drink it. It's way better than most anything that you get at a gallery opening. But there was something really bugging me. I couldn't figure out what was the matter with this wine. It just was dead. So I emailed the winemaker, and it was put through a centrifuge. I said, well, what makes that natural? You know, it's also probably extremely high yield, so there wasn't a whole lot of wine there. But it was this kind of thing that it was completely dead in a centrifuge. And it was a real good lesson for me because I had never knowingly had a centrifuged wine before.
Yeah. No, me neither. So it'd be interesting.
Yeah, they do centrifuge for removing alcohol as well.
Well, one of the things I think is so important that you talk about is the wine. And you mentioned even in this anecdote, like, you have to actually start from with a special place.
Yeah.
Good grapes. And then treat it naturally as right. well. You know, if I were to grow a couple of vines in Staten Island and not add any sulfur and not do anything, it doesn't mean that's going to be a
right.
special.
No, and you probably should test that ground for whatever it's got in
right,
it.
Right.
But I don't want to say that I'm against something like that, because I think the people who don't really care about wine, but really, they don't care about it deeply, about the sense of place, but they want something that's organic, that doesn't have any additives in it. They should have a wine like that. They just want a drink. That's fine. I just don't think that should be confused with a truly natural wine.
Mm-hmm. It seems like there's a lot of confusion.
There's a lot of confusion.
It seems that now natural wine has become so trendy. Obviously, when you have some like Action Bronson.
Yes.
You know, for most of natural wine's recent history, it's been a little bit of like a counterculture, insiders thing. And you've been sort of fighting the fight before anyone else. How do you feel now that it's become mainstream? Do you think it dilutes the essence of what natural wine is in any way?
Well, yeah, it certainly does dilute the essence because, you know, it has anarchist roots, which were, you know, it was rebellious. It still is actually in places like France where they have to fight the AOC, but there was a wonderful, remarkable spirit about it that people were not doing it to make money. People were doing it because they believed in it. And right now there are all these people flooding the market who are new to natural wine, doing natural wine clubs or like starting their natural wine events and some really pretty crappy ones that have nothing to do with natural wine. Even I'm cringing that there's going to be, as I see like festivals like Raw get bigger and bigger, and you know, it's sounding like the La Palais now and like Daniel Jonas. It's gotten so slick and expensive. I'm worried there's going to be a Club Med for natural wine, and all of this is just anti-natural wine. The fact of the matter is most of the Europeans are not wealthy, and a lot of these fairs are putting the burden on them to carry, and that's not quite fair, and I'm very protective of these people, and I don't want to see them taken advantage of. And I also don't like the crass commercialism that is now that people can make money off of natural wine, they're going to find a way to do it. And it's kind of getting a little bit ugly out there, too, with competitive natures and people using wine to launch stardom, as it could be any other thing. If they, you know, maybe they weren't able to pull it off as an actor, but they become natural wine influencers. It's kind of like, can you get off my island, please? natural wine will certainly survive it, but it's a little disturbing.
This episode is brought to you by 750.com. 750 is the indispensable resource for the beverage industry. It's something that I use on a daily basis, both for researching for my new wine book and my role as a buyer. You know, one of my favorite features about 750 is a really easy way that I can order products from my different sales reps. You can use 750's ordering tool to place your orders, and it autofills a order request for you and gives you a very concise and easy way to place orders in just a few easy clicks. I use the ordering tool all of the time. I don't have time to sit around writing long emails about the different products I want and the days I want them to come. So I just use 750 to place those orders, and it happens instantaneously. You felt that it was important to include a section on wine faults.
Yes.
In the book. I think if you were to write a book on rosé wine or orange wine or your wines of France, maybe you wouldn't have included wine faults as a section. Why was that important in the discussion of natural wine?
Because I know that this book is going to be read by natural wine enthusiasts as well as people who hate the stuff and want to figure out what it is. I felt it was extremely important to make this state that natural wine cannot be evaluated by the old WSET or Master Somm evaluation of what a wine is. Eventually, natural wine is going to go into its own form of education because it has to, because natural wine is going to define the way wine, good wine, is. That will be the definition, and I'm positive of that. So this was done as a way to educate that, well, you know, natural wine isn't always squeaky clean, and it should not necessarily be. If you put your nose in the glass and smell some volatility, a little bit of vinegar, a little bit of apple cider, a little bit of high toneness, that is not a flaw. In fact, it's part of the wine's life and traditional life. In fact, I think I have the quote from Elisabetta Fordori that if wine doesn't have any volatility, it doesn't have life. And I love that quote. And for me, mousiness, which we're seeing a lot of in natural wine, and that is a kombucha-like finish. It often feels like something is not complete there. I feel it is a complete fault because it can overtake the wine and obliterate its sense of place and its life. So I felt it was really necessary. If you drink wine, it really increases your pleasure to know how it's made, what can happen to the wine. So that's why.
I totally agree with you. For me, also mousiness, even in a small amount, just becomes really distracting. And I don't know if that's a personal, sounds like you share.
But I
can't, It's like a humming. It's like tinnitus or something. You know, it's like it, a humming that I can't like not pay there, right? attention to. It's always there, but you know, a small amount of volatile acidity or Brettanomyces. I feel like for me, if it's integrated and you can taste fruit, you can taste earth, you can taste other things.
Right, as long as it's not the only voice in the room, it's fine. And actually, even with mouse, I will tolerate. I'll get over myself. Like in the early days, remember, I used to call it puppy breath because I used to identify it on some early Darden-Rebo. Mm. And
but it's out. I haven't had been Darden-Rebo in the recent vintages, right?
A couple of vintages ago, I had a little bit again. But it was such a beautiful wine that it was. And there are some others that it's just a little bit. And so, like in my newsletter, I'll say, like, just drink up quickly. Do not decant the wine because it expands with oxygen. So there are times, and also there are times that it will resolve. You put it back in your, you know, in your cellar and take it out in 2 years, and then it goes away if the wine was well made. But of course, you and I are probably the 70% of the population who are sensitive to it, because 30% of the population cannot perceive mouse.
Is that true?
It is true.
I didn't know that.
Shocking, those lucky dogs.
I just assumed that they saw that as a signifier of something that was natural and like, oh, I like this because
it's natural and I identify it as natural.
Almost in a way that, you know, let's say men in blue shirts in the 90s tasted oak and black cherries and chocolate and like, oh, I understand this silver oak. Mm-hmm. You know, I understand this Napa Cab. So it must be good because it has a recognizable flavor in a good quality. But again, I really love how you've dispelled this myth that all natural wine has to be weird or strange, but especially the faulty. Like we can have an actual conversation about wine faults and flaws, and some of them can be components and some of them can be flaws.
I tell the story in the book about why the one reason though that I decided that this needed to be there, I was at a wine tasting in San Diego, Nat Diego, the first one they had. And this woman who's studying for WSET, she was going for, I think, level 3, and asked whether she could follow me as I tasted. And then after a couple of wines, she said, can I ask you a question? Do you taste for faults first? And I just burst out laughing. And I'm like, no, I taste for pleasure first, and then I work backwards. But this idea that somebody is actually first going through wines to look for faults was so backwards to me. It was the antithesis of the way I work.
It's the WCT thing.
Yeah.
It's the first thing. I know I went through, I did the diploma. It was my first wine education. The first thing is it faulty or not? Like that's your first, then you analyze the fruit. I found it was useful for me in like my early education, but not something that I go to anymore. Especially as a lover of Italian wine and, you know, I guess it's common to say Italian wines have Brett and VA, but a lot of my favorite ones do. I love like the Le Boncier wines, which always have a little bit.
They do, and they're beautiful.
And they're beautiful. Palo Bayo wines, especially VA.
Especially. especially more and more lately.
More and more lately. I
just tasted with him in March, and I'm like, huh.
Yeah. I might be leaning towards his like white wines a little bit more like
that. Yeah, I know the skin contact that's where this is a total like tangent. But from the time that I first visited with Giampiero to now, it's like it's been a whole world of difference going on there.
Really?
The wines never had this much VA.
They never had this much VA.
I don't know if it's the new winery.
Interesting.
I don't know. Hmm. But anyway, they've gotten more and more old world tasting. Interesting stuff. But yeah, VA and Brett, no problem with it as long as it's not the only.
Other than natural wines becoming mainstream for consumers, how else have you seen the natural wine world change in these years since you started writing books about them?
How other than that you can probably go to every state in the United States and find a place to drink natural wine or buy natural wine, the fact that
Every state.
I think pretty much, except I think even Kentucky.
Wow.
Probably. There is a natural wine shop in Naples, Florida.
Wow.
This is one of the mistakes in the book. I'd like to give it a call out because I feel so guilty about this. The shop in Naples, Florida is Natural Wine Naples. And, you know, they're trying to like, and there's another one up north. There's a natural wine bar in Orlando. In Orlando. How mainstream is that?
It's incredible.
So that's one way. How else has it changed other than now we're getting a little bit slick?
Are there other regions that are new? Obviously, France was...
Started in France, creeped over in Italy. Well, I remember in 2006, it was so hard to find natural wines in Italy. Yes, Bea. But I remember when Elisabetta popped up in Louis Dresner portfolio, and that would be going back to Elisabetta Foradori, and I remember those wines when she first, and I was resistant to tasting them because I knew what they used to be like, but I hadn't known her backstory and how genuine it was. But that was the beginning. In 2006, 2007, you saw this dramatic change in Italy as I started not following Parker, and now it's, you know, it's a fantastic spot for delicious natural wines. And then Spain has exploded out of the tiny little group in Catalonia. Georgia has come on strong. Slovakia, Czech Republic. Australia has gone natural. Vermont has a booming natural wine, you know, industry. Right.
Not just La Garagista, there's other.
Well, they're starting, give it 5 years.
Okay.
But it has started and...
With a lot of hybrids.
Yeah, the people are embracing hybrids. It'll spread to New Hampshire. There are people, oddly enough, you know, there are natural wines in California, but it's still a little iffy. People are not necessarily using organic fruit. Of course, some people are filtering probably, so they don't use that much sulfur instead of just letting it happen. Yeah, the trouble with getting organic vineyards and fruit is a big problem in California. Wow.
I imagine someone who is making natural wine in, let's say, a wetter climate, a little more humid climate, mm-hmm. looking at someone in California who is not doing it. And they're like, come on, guys.
Yeah, right.
It's so dry and sunny there.
What is your problem? The problem, I think, is that it's large, mostly large vineyards. And the idea of small 2-acre plots doesn't really exist, mm-hmm. which is, you know, the way you've got to do it. You know, and most people can't afford to farm their own land. So that's, you know, you have to get the big guys to come on board, and the big guys are all-time farmers. Though Heights, which I don't think is necessarily going to be making natural wine anytime soon, but who knows, going to be the largest biodynamic farmer in California.
Wow.
So that's pretty awesome.
That is awesome. Have you found that there are, okay, so there's industrial organic. Is there anyone who's really like dedicated to biodynamics or say is growing biodynamically who maybe doesn't fit into the natural wine world?
Yeah, there are. There are a lot of biodynamic vineyards that are also making wine that are just biodynamic fruit in conventional bottles, without a doubt. Yeah.
You visited Fabio Gea.
Yes.
I also visited him recently.
You did?
What a memorable...
When did you go?
I went in the end of May.
Cool.
Wild.
Totally wild. I'm sure it was just as wild as...
He had a room, you know, he's building out that crazy farmhouse.
Yes. Has he started work on it? Because I haven't seen him for 2 years.
Kind of.
not really. You saw did you see the mother shit?
The mother shit. I saw the mother shit. Did you see there's a room that he said it's his burlesque room where he's going to invite everyone, man, woman, animal, alien,
carriages? Yes.
To do self-expression.
Yes,
right?
Yes. Yeah, it's one of Fabio's dreams. I don't know whether it's because he can't even dress himself in the morning. So it's, but we'll see if that actually happens. But he's got this wonderful, wild vision of what's going to happen to that place.
It was sort of thrilling to see that in Barbaresco, a place that's
totally.
It's almost conservative, and rightfully so, because the land is so expensive. And this monoculture, and seeing someone just being a little crazy.
Well, and people have been afraid of him, like, you know, the crazy person. I try to make a couple of matches in the neighborhood, but I hope that he's really not as, he's okay. I love Fabio.
I love him too. I kept oscillating between he's a genius, he's out of his mind, he's a genius.
It's a fine line. I worry about him.
Yeah. Where else do you see exciting natural wine things happening in Italy?
I think when you talk about where's the greatest concentration? It's, for me, it's Amelia, which is, I was thinking about this coming over. It is probably the one place that I probably can, there's so many of them that have emerged there. And probably the same reason that there's so many in the Languedoc or Loire is because land prices were cheaper. And so it's possible. And there's also, actually, I did a story for World of Fine Wine a couple of years ago about this. It has a lot of political reasons. It has been a source of resistance and political resistance, and that factors over into their personalities and the way they make wine. So that, to me, is probably one of the most exciting spots in Italy for natural wine.
And that's the sort of northern Emilia-Romagna part, by Piacenza, by where La Stoppa is, in that area.
A little bit also west of there, so right around like Modena, Parma.
Any other exciting producers? I was speaking with Joy Cull of La Valana
recently. I was just going to say that I think where she is, that area in Guardole in Lazio, is becoming a little hippie commune of natural winemakers.
She was telling me the same story where, you know, she could buy, she actually buy land here, or she could, you know, buy a house, and everything is a lot less expensive than if you're in a more famous area. And that allows her, she was saying how she is planting a vineyard with 15 heirloom grapes and just trying it out. It's just going to co-ferment it. You can't do that in Barbaresco, really.
No, though, who's doing it? Well,
Is someone doing something like that?
There is. Well, Fabio's got some stuff that he shouldn't have. well, you're going to see that kind of thing more in Roero, I think, but not in Barbaresco, and certainly not in Barolo.
Certainly not in Barolo,
It's a little bit like in Burgundy. You're just not going to like mess around too much. But that part of Lazio, it's is pretty exciting, and there's stuff there. And you go to, I just visited Frascati for the first time. So it's a half an hour from Rome. It's €2 to go to Frascati. And of course, there's only one reason to go to Frascati. And of course, because my brain is not working today, I can't remember what Daniela's winery is called. But it's all, you know, they've made such crappy wine for such a long time. And there, the land is expensive because you're dealing as a bedroom community with Rome. So where you can't really renovate or resuscitate Frascati, you can deeper into Lazio.
Yeah, and she's by Gradoli, which is like 2 hours away.
Right.
It was, gives me a hard time that I told her it was close to Rome.
Yeah, it's not.
It's not.
No.
No. There's no easy way to get there. And I wonder if places like Calabria or parts of Puglia might be the next. I know you recently did a tasting with Fatalone.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think 10 years ago, I wouldn't even think of having a wine from Puglia.
Yeah.
You know, maybe Gutarolo in the first vintages that they came out. Mm-hmm. But it was sort of just like, you know, Primitivo and these just like juicy red wines that just taste like juicy fruit or something.
Yeah, which is a real shame because there used to be so many beautiful traditional wines. Even Torino Cosimo back in the day was perfect. I bet if I found a bottle from the 90s now, it would still be delicious. Mm-hmm. But when they modernized and everything got thrown out, and that's the way the whole, you know, happened to Calabria, happened to Campania, happened to Puglia. And so now Puglia is starting to come back. There are a few people, still not a lot. Calabria, a little bit, still not a lot, but there are more. And Campania, a little bit, not a lot.
A little bit, not a lot. Yeah. Mostly around like Luigi Tecce and that area.
Yeah. Yeah. And
not a lot. There's so much potential. Agnanum, that's a good, I feel like there might be a natural wine producer. I think there's so much potential in Campania. That should be
without
like
a doubt.
A world-class wine area.
Yeah, like if you like older, like before Mastroberdino, like throughout the old tanks and the old ways. I mean, those wines are beautiful, the old stuff. I don't understand how you can make wine like that and then decide it's no good and modernize. Mm-hmm. How does that, how does somebody, I don't know, in my first book, In the Battle for Wine and Love, I talked about going to Penn Station as a little girl, and it was like weeks before they were going to destroy it, and looking up at this amazing papier-mâché ceiling that even as a five-year-old, I knew what I was looking at. And like, how would you destroy this? I don't know.
It's unbelievable.
But natural wine's bringing that back. even as the crass commercializers are coming in to make money off of it, it still will show the way.
I believe that's true. Congratulations again on Natural Wine for the People. I absolutely love it. Are you doing any events coming up that we can let people know about?
I do. I'll be in California in Los Angeles helping Jill Bernheimer celebrate her 10 years of Domaine LA. September 9th and 10th, I'm up in San Francisco. The 9th at Omnivore Bookshop and the 10th at Verjus Wine Bar. Then on the 12th, I'm back in Brooklyn with Melissa Clark interviewing me at Archistratos Bookstore in Williamsburg or Greenpoint. And then a whole bunch of stuff. So you can check the events page of thefiringline.com to find out where I'm going to be next.
I should say I'm a subscriber to The Firing Line, and you should too. It's really great. I love that essay that you did, the essay contest recently.
Yes, that was a beautiful essay, wasn't it?
So beautiful. And so you could see Alice's tips and wine recommendations and just beautiful writing. So please, you should definitely subscribe to The Firing Line. Thank you so much, Alice.
Thanks.
It's been great. That was a great conversation with Alice Firing. I want to give a huge thanks to our super talented producer, Jessamine Molly. She is the best. Thanks so much to Rennie Lopez for our theme music. And again, when I'm not hosting In the Drink, you can find me at Fausto or Lalu. Hope to see you there.